Welcome to the Solari Food Series Podcast. This is your host, Pete Kennedy. It's an honor to have Congressman Tom Massey as our guest today. Officially, Tom represents Kentucky's 4th District in Washington. Unofficially, he's the congressman for the local food movement in this country. Two of the biggest factors that have led to the loss of small farms in the U.S. have been mandatory pasteurization laws and the 1967 Wholesome Meat Act. Congressman Massey has introduced bills to address both problems. He is the lead sponsor on the Raw Milk Freedom Act, and he is also the lead sponsor on today's topic, the Processing Revival and Intrastate Meat Exemption Act, also known as the PRIME Act. Representative Massey has been working nonstop on these bills, so let's get into it right away. Congressman Massey, welcome to the Solari Food Series Podcast.
Hey, Pete, thanks for having me on. I would like to give a shout out to my bipartisan cohort on these bills, Shelley Pingree from Maine. She's also a leader in the local food freedom movement, and she's on the other side of the aisle. So we've got a Democrat and a Republican. She is the lead co-sponsor on both of those bills that you mentioned, the PRIME Act and the Raw Milk Act. So excited to have her and other Democrats on this as well. But thanks for giving me credit.
Okay.
We also, in the past, we worked on hemp a lot. I was instrumental in getting the industrial hemp farming amendment language on the 2014 Farm Bill. I worked with two other Democrats on that, Jared Polis, who's now the governor of Colorado, and Earl Blumenauer, who's a representative still in Congress.
And also a co-sponsor of the PRIME Act, correct?
Yes. Jared and I, just quick story about the governor of Colorado, in case there are any people from Colorado listening to this. We co-sponsored all these food and farm freedom bills, the hemp, the raw milk, the beef bills. And he found out I was going to be out in Colorado, ironically campaigning for a Republican out there. I was going to go come out and do a fundraiser for Ken Buck. But Jared Polis caught wind of it, and he asked me if I wanted to come and eat a lot of illicit and unapproved food in front of a TV camera in Denver. So I said, all right, yeah, sure. What do you want me to bring? So I brought beef on the airplane, uninspected beef, smuggled it into Denver. He had some raw milk. I don't know who his supplier was. We had kombucha. We had hemp smoothies. We had some backyard chicken eggs. None of this had gone through, you know, the official channels, the government approved channels. And he found a restaurant in Denver that was willing to let us use their kitchen. And I'm not sure which news station, maybe Channel 9 or something, came in and filmed us eating all of this stuff. And then they did a segment that evening. And as I was leaving, I whispered to Jared, I was like, hey, if you get sick after eating all this stuff, whether it's from the food or not, make sure you go to a veterinarian, not a doctor, because we would set the food freedom movement back if we got sick. The reality is, we were healthier than ever, as anybody is who eats, and we didn't have anything to worry about. But that's my quick story about one of the adventures I had in Denver, Colorado, with the now governor of Colorado.
Well, like the title of the book goes, everything I want to do is illegal, right?
Yeah, everything we wanted to eat was illegal
right.
That day.
Right. Okay, let's start on the PRIME Act. Just tell me what the PRIME Act does, or tell our listeners what the PRIME Act does. What are the problems it's trying to address?
Sure. So the PRIME Act was conceived on Joel Salatin's farm in Virginia. I think I was on a hay wagon taking like my fourth tour of Joel Salatin's farm, but it never gets old. And there was a state senator from Tennessee, Frank Nicely. And this was, I think, in 2015. They were just getting rid of country of origin labeling for beef in the United States. Congress did that at the behest of the World Trade Organization. And we were talking about and lamenting about how difficult it is for farmers to market to consumers and some of the exemptions that existed, like the poultry exemption for, I think it's 20,000 birds or less. Right. You would know better than me. And we said, we need something like that for beef. And so he and I came up with the idea that if people can sell half a cow to a consumer using a processor that's not USDA approved, and nobody gets sick, and nobody's ever gotten sick from that, from eating half a cow, then why not let them sell a hamburger or a steak instead of half a cow? Let the farmer sell cuts of meat and use the same types of processors. And we thought, should we limit it numerically, right? We're not trying to create some loophole for the mega processing plants, four of them, four companies own 85% of the processing capability of the United States. And we're not trying to create a loophole for them. In fact, they like the regulations, so we'll let them keep living by the regulations. And by the way, all of the recalls have come from these big processors, none from the small processors. So we said, instead of limiting this numerically, you know, we thought, well, maybe 100 steers and 300 hogs. And as long as you stayed under those numbers every year as a farmer or a processor, then, you know, you could enjoy this expanded exemption. And instead of doing that, we decided to do it geographically. And that achieves a couple things. So what the Prime Act says is that you can sell meat to a local consumer using a local processor, as long as the local processor is in compliance with county and state laws. They don't have to have a full-time USDA regulator on site. They don't have to abide by a lot of these onerous regulations. As long as you are in the same state, it's the farmer, the processor, and the consumer all in the same state. So we used a geographic exemption instead of a numerical exemption, because sometimes the small business exemption just keeps small businesses small. And what we really wanted to do was to, you know, if there is going to be some constraint, let's keep local food local, okay? And so that's what it does. It just says, knock yourself out, sell a hamburger, sell steak, sell a roast to your neighbor using a local processor, as long as you're all in. And that also is basically how all of the laws should work at the federal level, frankly. If there's no interstate nexus, then why is the federal government involved? So there's sort of a pragmatic reason for the way we designed this bill, but also a constitutional reason.
Right. And the Prime Act, this is the third session it's been introduced. And the first session, couple sessions, I think it had between 20 and 25 sponsors each session. And this session has just exploded. Yeah. You're at 50 sponsors now on the House side. Can you talk about the developments the last few months in the conventional system that have led to that?
Yeah, well, the conventional system's always been broken, but nobody knew how broken it was until COVID exposed the weaknesses, the brittleness that's in the supply chain as far as getting food from the farmer to the consumer. What we saw during COVID was we saw shortages in the supermarkets. Even at Wendy's, you couldn't buy hamburger for a while here in Kentucky. But we saw shortages in the supermarket. We saw rationing in the supermarket. And we're still seeing some of that. But more than anything, we're seeing higher prices in the supermarket. Meanwhile, farmers are seeing all-time lows for the animals that they are selling the processors. So this problem has existed for a long time. That is, the fact that farmers are having a hard time selling locally to consumers, and therefore the meat processing has been monopolized, and the meat processors are the main benefactor of these regulations. They keep the little guys out, and they allow them to exploit the meat processors. They can exploit the farmers who can't get much for their animals and have no other outlet or opportunity to sell their animals other than to sell to this oligopoly. So that's why I introduced it 5 years ago. But you're right, we've got double the number of co-sponsors. We're over 50 in the House, and we have about 9 co-sponsors in the Senate, I think. For the longest time, it was just Senator Angus King, who's the prime sponsor. By the way, what a name to sponsor a bill called the Prime Act. that I have to remind people, this is also for pork and lamb, but Senator Angus King, his name alone is a great marketing tool for this bill in the Senate. He is, again, another person on the other side of the aisle. Even though he runs as independent, he caucuses with the Democrats. He and Senator Rand Paul have been sponsors. And then this year, we picked up both of the senators from Tennessee. We've got senators from Montana, Utah, I believe North Dakota. And so we're picking up a lot of support this year because consumers are concerned, and rightfully so. They're paying more attention now that they can't get the meat. And the congressmen and senators who I've been talking to for 5 years trying to explain this problem, it finally came into focus for them when the COVID outbreak happened and we saw several of the big processing plants shut down.
This is one of the biggest shifts I've seen. We've always been on this cheap food, high healthcare cost paradigm. And this is just one of the biggest shifts I've seen over to people spending more of their money on food and, yeah, just hopefully less of their money on healthcare. And you know of what you speak about this. Being a farmer yourself, if you could talk a little bit about your farm operation and the demand you've seen or other farmers you've spoken with have seen over the last 4 months.
Sure. So part of my farm is a hobby farm. I'll admit I raise some chickens and process them myself. But the part of our farm that's full scale is our cattle production. I have 60 cattle, and these are beef cattle. I manage the herd myself. I rotate them from pasture to pasture. I haul them to the processing facilities myself. I market them on Facebook. My wife markets them. My daughter helps market them. She lives in Louisville, Kentucky, which is more of an urban center than where we live. So she's running shipments of meat down to Louisville every now and then. And just a quick point there. My wife sold a half a steer to her hairdresser. You know, under the lockdown, my wife couldn't go to her hairdresser for the longest time. And so after like 3 months, she finally got to go to her hairdresser, and she texted me and she said, I just sold my hairdresser half a steer. And then, you know, like 30 minutes later, she's like, oh, the other hairdresser bought the other half. And so you talk about shifts. And I'm like, I'm thinking about this. I mean, that's several thousand, that's a couple thousand dollars of meat. Okay. And I, when my wife got home, I said, how did they afford that? Like, did you have to give her a discount or something? Can we still make money on this animal? Why are you selling your hairdresser $1,000 of beef in one sitting? And she said, she charges me $130 to do my hair. Don't worry about it, honey. At which point I became a little distraught that my wife spends $130 on her hair. But anyways, that to your point, you do see a shift. You see people who haven't been seeking out healthy, wholesome local food are now seeking it out, and not for a lower price, but because they want a better product.
Right. And you also just see existing customers just increasing their orders, right? They're a little bit more worried about their food supply and their...
Yes. And so my daughter's fiance works for General Electric, and he designs the assembly lines that manufacture the appliances. And if you've tried to go buy a freezer, a deep freezer here recently, you've noticed the same problem you have with beef. There are shortages and the prices have gone up. The inventory is at zero because people are more concerned about food security. And so they're willing to buy in larger quantities, maybe not the kind of quantities they're buying toilet paper in, but they are willing to buy a bigger quantity of beef, especially when they find a good supplier for it. And it's become easier temporarily. I think it's somewhat temporary. It's become easier for farmers to market this beef. Simultaneously, farmers are spending more time trying to find these outlets because they're getting crushed at the stockyards when you go to the auction and sell animals. By the way, Pete, full disclosure, I'm in Congress. I don't have time or the resources to market all of my cattle directly. And so occasionally I go to the stockyard and I experience the humiliation that comes with like running eight or animals into the ring and watching them sell for less than what it costs you to make it, watching them sell for less than you could sell them for if you just turned them into hamburger, even if you ignored the steaks and the animals. Right. And so I've seen both sides of this coin in my own small business endeavor. By the way, another disclosure here, sometimes I've had people on Twitter saying that I'm just trying to enrich my own bank account by pushing the Prime Act. And they say, well, how much do you stand to benefit from this, Congressman Massey? And I say, well, I've got approximately 50 cattle, the time I had 50 cattle, and there are 50 million beef cattle in the United States. So if this bill passes and I'm able to direct market all of my beef, I could receive 1/1,000,000th of the benefit that this bill would convey to Americans. And so, well, and that's before you consider pork and lamb, which I don't raise.
Well, the other thing I've heard you say, Tom, is that if this bill passed, you could just put your truck in neutral and roll down the hill to your custom house. So you'd save a lot on your gas bill, too, wouldn't you?
It's a very green bill. This is why Democrats, I think, support it as well. That's true, Pete. I told you that I've sold at the auction, in the sale ring, and I've also sold direct to consumers. But on the direct to consumer route, I've used four different processors. And the USDA processor that I've used is about 3 hours from my house. And I have to take my old pickup truck and load this trailer up and make sure there's air in the tires and the lights work and drive this thing on the interstate for 3 hours, drop off the cattle, drive an empty trailer back 3 hours. Although I can usually do the return trip in 2.5 hours. And then when the meat is ready, I drive 3 hours again to go get the meat and drive back with it. I mean, that is not very green. Meanwhile, I've got a processor that is 3.5 miles from my farm. And the elevation of the, in Kentucky, we have some hills. My farm, the field where I load my cattle, is at about 600 feet above sea level. And his facility is about 200 feet lower than that, 400 feet above sea level. So I can put my truck in neutral and literally coast to the local processor and use virtually no fuel getting the animals there. And then when it's time to pick it up, well, either the customer can go to him and pick it up. And technically this is not, you're not supposed to do this. It's questionable whether, you know, the USDA would like to hear me say this, but I'm going to say it and they can come and handcuff me if they want. I can go pick it up and take it to the customer. I do that sometimes, but in any case, with a processor that's 3 miles from here and downhill, it doesn't get any greener than that. He's non-USDA. And so when I'm selling through him, I have to sell like a half of an animal at a time, not a package of hamburger or a steak at a time. And that's the difference we have here.
By the way, Tom, I've checked. USDA won't slap the handcuffs on you. You can be an agent for the people, the owners of the animal getting meat from you. So you're good on that.
Good.
What we're also seeing just is the backup for these local farmers, the ones that market direct to the consumers. They've always had a tough time just scheduling slaughter dates, but now it's crazy. I talked to one farmer in May that said it's May, or his local USDA facility is booking out in 2022. A lot of the custom houses are booking out in 2021 right now. What do you hear from the farmers you speak with?
So the USDA facility won't even book me now. Like, we tried to get an appointment. Either they're embarrassed about how far out it is, or I suspect they're doing the financially sane thing, which is they have a retail outlet and cattle are at an all-time low. And they've got the magic facility that takes a very low-priced commodity and turns it into a very high-priced commodity. And so rather than, you know, shop out that facility to other farmers, I suspect they're doing more of their own in-house at this point and marketing that directly. And by the way, I talked to Joel Salatin, and he mused that he's a part owner in a USDA facility. And he was joking that, you know, we would make more money selling options on the opportunity to have your animal slaughtered than we would on the animals that we're having slaughtered at our own facility. So my USDA place is 3 hours away, won't even put anybody on the calendar now. And then my local non-USDA shop, my custom slaughterhouse, is 3 miles down the road. He was backed up till April of 2021 when my wife made an appointment last month. He went from being August to a few weeks later, he was into December, to a few weeks later, he was into April. And now I suspect if I called him, it would be a full year before I could get anything done there. And you know, they, when you're in business, right, and you've got to invest capital to expand your facility, you have to try and recognize what is a fleeting market demand and what is a constant market demand. And he is expanding his facility some to deal with this demand, but he can't be sure that it's still going to be there after the virus goes away. That's why the PRIME Act is important. If you want to see people make a permanent, long-term investment, you have to prove to them that the conditions in the market are going to be favorable for them to earn a return on their investment, not within 6 months, but over the next 6 to 10 years.
Right. And the way the PRIME Act works is that once it passes Congress, it's still up to the state to pass laws allowing the custom sale. And you can, as if we needed more evidence that the PRIME Act needs to get passed now, you see all these different states just raising money, trying to expand their slaughterhouse capacity. We saw Utah just was sending out feelers to the custom houses, see if they'd be willing to become state-inspected slaughter facilities. Mississippi issued an emergency rule on custom slaughter, so you didn't have to order at least a quarter animal. You could order any quantity you wanted. And you were telling me in Kentucky now that the Department of Agriculture is dipping into the tobacco relief fund.
Yes.
To help custom processors. So these states are searching everywhere for the money now.
Yeah, in Kentucky, there's a board that administers tobacco settlement money. So a few years ago, the tobacco companies were sued by the states, and some of the states chose to take all that money and invest it in healthcare. But Kentucky was one of the states where they put some of it into healthcare, and I think they kept half of it to try and help farmers. And there have been some dubious investments of that money. And my hat's off to the farmers who've tried to do some creative things instead of raising tobacco. But I actually believe this is probably the best use of that tobacco settlement money that we've ever seen here in Kentucky, is to invest it in matching grants for those facilities that choose to expand. The grants, like 75% from the state tobacco settlement money and 25% from the farmer. But here's the irony, Pete. The PRIME Act doesn't spend any money. You don't need to spend any money. The market will respond. These people that have these custom slaughterhouses are some of the most entrepreneurial people you could meet. And they will respond if the market conditions change permanently. You won't need to spend money if you just tell them we've got a new opportunity here. And another reason, just back on why the customs shops are so backed up, the beef price, the cattle prices have gone way down. And farmers are looking at basically going and taking a beating at the auction ring if they take their cattle there. Hay was at an all-time high last winter, and it's hard to even pay for the hay you fed them last winter when you take them to the auction house. And so they're looking for alternate paths. And, you know, even if just 5% or 10% of cattle farmers sold directly to consumers using the opportunity that the PRIME Act presents, I think that would force the oligopoly that are the four meat packers that control the industry to pay a fairer price for those cattle if the farmers have the option to go somewhere else, right? When you're at the table and you can't walk away, you're going to get the worst deal there is. But anytime you go to the table to negotiate and you have the ability to walk away from the table, even if you only walk away from the table one in 20 times, even if only 5% of farmers sell direct to consumers using the Prime Act, that will give them an option to walk away from those big four, and the big four are going to have to pay a more fair price.
Right. You can see the analogy with pasteurized milk and raw milk. If raw milk is illegal in the state, a farmer can only go through the commodity system, and they pay a fraction of what they could get just selling raw milk direct to the consumers. And just, Tom, further contributing to the backlog, I spoke with a farmer from Oregon yesterday who basically got kicked out of one slaughterhouse he was using, because what's happening, some of these hog farmers in a state like Iowa, instead of euthanizing their pigs, which I know you've spoken about, what they'll do is they'll just send them slaughter-ready pigs for maybe $100 to people around the country. And that happened out where he was. And now he doesn't have a big enough order for the slaughterhouse. So if he gets pushed further back in line and is even looking for another slaughterhouse.
Yeah. We saw that in Ohio on Facebook. People here in Kentucky were driving up to Ohio because there was a Facebook ad. One of those, and Ohio raises more pork than Kentucky does. Kentucky is more of a beef state. We're the largest cattle producer east of the Mississippi, but Ohio, I would say, dwarfs us in pork production. And people were driving up there and buying those, like you say, $100 or $200 hogs that were ready to go, and getting creative, either trying to find a processor or doing it themselves.
Have you heard of that many of these commodity farmers just breaking off and trying to sell their cattle or hogs direct through, just marketing direct right now? Or is that something you think that'll happen more down the line?
Well, you know, you've got states like Iowa, where a lot of production is concentrated in one state. And if every citizen in Iowa ate pork for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and that's all they ate, they still couldn't consume all the pork that they produce in Iowa. So I think they've kind of got a problem there. Like for the mega production, mega facilities, it's going to be hard for them to go direct. I don't even think they have the trailers and the equipment to haul the stuff, right? A lot of times that's contracted out and it's done by the processing plant. So right, it's hard for them to go from zero to 60. I think some of the smaller folks in the margin have done that, but it's mostly, I think, more of the smaller independent farmers who've done it. And I see it happen more with cattle here in Kentucky, but maybe that's just because I'm surrounded by cattle.
I don't know how much you've talked to just state officials in other states, but there are about half the states right now that don't even have their own meat inspection program, like Kentucky, Florida, where I am, is another one. And they need the Prime Act even worse than the other half of the states. Are you seeing any interest on the state level? You're seeing state officials getting involved with their congressmen and encouraging them to co-sponsor the bill?
I've talked to our ag commissioner, Ryan Quarles, and trying to, you know, put this on his radar, although this is a job, you know, for me to pass in Congress. I see interest in it, but like in a state like Kentucky, the legislature only meets once a year for a few weeks, and our legislature is out of session. Somebody could pre-file a bill now. And so we need to be talking to these legislators and these legislatures now, so that when they go back into session, like in Kentucky, they go into session in January, they can implement these programs. In Kentucky, my local processor, for instance, the Custom Slaughterhouse, even though there is no state inspection program that could fill in for the federal inspection program in Kentucky, my local Custom Slaughterhouse is still inspected by the local health department, just like any restaurant, right? If you've got a kitchen back there, the restaurant has to be periodically inspected. He's subject to the same sort of inspection. And also, he's still subject to surprise inspections by the USDA. He's had them roll up and inspect his facility. And he's like, look, I got nothing to hide here. Look around, knock yourself out. At any moment, they could do that. They didn't call ahead. it wasn't necessarily adversarial, but just sort of explaining the regime in Kentucky is you've got local inspections by the health departments for the custom shops, and then they're subject to surprise inspections. I don't know if the answer is to add more bureaucracy and regulation at the state level. I'm hesitant to encourage Kentucky to adopt their own inspection regime. Nobody's getting sick eating half an animal or a quarter of an animal using a local slaughterhouse, buying from a local farmer. So I would encourage them to use the Prime Act, if we can get it passed, that exemption, and use a local processor and the local health departments. I don't really think there's a need to implement more regulation.
Right. You see a couple of bills in Congress right now that would allow state-inspected meat to be sold in interstate commerce. Just the thinking being that the states have to be at least as strict as the federal rules anyway, so why can't they sell across state lines just like the USDA facilities? But
frankly, I was shocked to find out that they couldn't. Like, because Kentucky doesn't have a state program, I've never had meat processed under one of those state programs. So I wasn't aware that you couldn't sell it across state lines. And I think that's a great bill. It's mostly being pushed, again, by the states, by senators and congressmen in the states that have state programs. And I would be very supportive of that. I'm not sure that it would expand the opportunity for a processor in a state, you know, like Utah or like Iowa. I don't know. Does Iowa have their own state program?
They do. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm just thinking of states that are net exporters of animals. That would be an issue for them.
Well, there's a cooperative interstate program or shipping program right now, where states that have their own state inspection program, if they get approved by USDA, they can allow small state inspected plants with 25 or fewer employees to sell the meat in interstate commerce. But there are only, I think, 7 states out of whatever it is, 27, that have a state meat inspection program that have joined that right now. So I agree with you. I think that bill would increase access, but nothing would increase access like the Prime Act.
Here's another thing, Pete. I'm not against it. I'm for free markets, but it won't foster local food in the way that the Prime Act does. The Prime Act is about allowing people to sell to their neighbor. It's not about allowing somebody in Kentucky to sell in California.
Right. And just when you think of processing revival, I mean, one part of that, I think, is just bringing back the community abattoir, which we've lost so many of over the last 50 years or so. And then another part is one big deal right now with the Prime Act, maybe most important part of it, in just leading on to a rapid increase of slaughterhouses, is that these custom houses right now are not subject to the HACCP regulation. And the HACCP regulations that USDA have are just these extensive paperwork requirements. Joel Saladin has talked about them. He said if the Prime Act passed, his costs would go down 30%, and he could pass that on to the consumer just because he wouldn't have to fiddle with all the HACCP paperwork. Just what, under HACCP, basically, you're supposed to devise this plan, naming possible hazards, critical control points in your facility, that USDA wants a written plan about what you're going to do to address these hazards at the critical control points. And one of the problems with it is if an inspector doesn't like your HACCP plan, you try and tell the inspector, well, what do I need to do? And they go, well, that's up to you to figure out. So it can be used as a club against the small inspector. And I know you've said you've talked to a number of these slaughterhouse operators or former slaughterhouse operators who still have the building and are willing to start up again if the Prime Act passes. Do you think they'd start up if they had if there had to be an on-site inspector or there had to be a HACCP plan?
No, you're asking them again to put everything at risk to something arbitrary, to one person, one bureaucrat who could shut you down if they don't like their commute, you know. And I just think it's not something they would do. And I've heard Joel say that it does add 30% to the cost there, but he also says that by the time it gets to the supermarket, you know, if you're trying to sell it to consumer, that becomes 50%. And so if you're going to open a local facility and you have to sell ground beef at $6 a pound right next to ground beef that's selling at $4 a pound, it's going to be tough, because those regulations, the HACCP regulations you're talking about, those are the, it's the same regulation whether you're processing, you know, 1,000 animals or 12 animals. And so the percent of hassle and overhead goes up when you have fewer animals if you have to deal with that. So it's definitely what is Joel Salatin says, they're size prejudicial, they these regulations. Most, he's got some great words, but they've got 4 or 5 syllables.
Yeah, but just what we're seeing right now, just organizations at the Legal Defense Fund, they just did a survey in Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. Their greatest concern among the members that responded to the survey was lack of access to slaughterhouses. And you can just see week by week how all these facilities in just about every area of the country are pushing back their deadlines when farmers can book. And eventually, if something like the Prime Act doesn't pass, it might get to a choice where these small livestock farmers marketing direct just have to make a choice. Do I go out of business or do I break the law?
Well, and this whole food supply chain is, the disruption is like, it's sort of like a slinky, okay? At first, the first disruption was that restaurants shut down. And so the packaging wasn't proper for the outlet, for the demand, right? So you had, in the beginning, a little bit of a glut of frozen food or you know, frozen beef reserves, because it wasn't packaged for direct consumers, it was packaged for restaurants, and the price went down. But that was the first bottleneck. And then the next bottleneck was the processors weren't able to process. And you saw this also in the milk. You saw them pouring out milk and whatnot. But the next part of the slinky that we're going to see, Pete, is farmers are acting rationally. They see all the things stacking up and piling up, and they're not breeding back like the sows, right, as quickly. Because if they have no certainty that they can market the hogs when they're grown, why even have a pig give birth to one, right? So they're not breeding them back. And you, in the case of dairy, at the USDA facility, it's a custom USDA facility. It's sort of like a unicorn, okay? The one that's 3 hours from my house. They'll do custom stuff, but it's a USDA facility. But it's still, it's more expensive than a regular facility. I saw dairy cattle being dropped off there the last time I dropped cattle off there. Like when you take a dairy cow out of, and these look like productive dairy cattle, right? They didn't look like old ones. And when you take those out of the dairy system, it takes 3 years to get another, you know, lactating cow, you know, from conception, right? So what we're seeing now, and I think you're going to see this later, is that because farmers are scaling back, unfortunately, some of them are going out of business and some of them are just throwing up their hands and saying, okay, I'm not playing this game. You know, a year ago, I decided to go to double my scale because I wasn't making money. And now I'm losing twice as much money because things got worse, not better. I'm going to give this up and I'm just going to raise soybeans and corn. Okay. Or tobacco. That's a farmer that I talked to here in my district recently. He said, you know, I went from 100 to 200 cattle because I thought I bought the story that I need a bigger scale. He said, by the way, I raise soybeans and corn and tobacco. And he said, I'm operating on like a 3% margin right now. And he said, and I'm losing $100 a head on the cattle. He said, I can't keep this up. So folks like that are going to get out of the cattle market. The dairy farmers, I mean, they've been hit for 30 years We've seen mass extinction of the dairy farmer and consolidation. Right. And so our capacity is going to go down. And here's what I'm afraid of, Pete. When we're already starting to see this, I think we're going to end up importing more of our food. And this is the sad thing, because of our own stupid regulations are putting our farmers out of business, keeping our consumers from accessing the meat that the farmers are producing. So now we're going to buy from foreign countries that, even if they somehow get a USDA label on that meat when it comes in, I can guarantee you it's not raised as conscientiously or as healthy as the domestic food is. So that's the real tragedy here. And one of the, this is the irony, you know, I've talked to the USDA about the Prime Act at fairly high levels. And one of their objections was, it'll probably run afoul of our trade rules, that if we let our farmers have some relief from regulation and we don't give the same relief to the imported products, then we'll run afoul of the WTO and the USTR. And I just thought, wow, now this is irony. We're like our own regulations. They're saying we got, the beatings have to continue. It's what they're telling me.
Right. It's, well, another irony is USDA has this campaign called Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food. And with these country of origin labeling laws you mentioned earlier, you can't even know your country. Could you explain how sometimes people think they're buying made in the USA beef and they're not?
Well, when I got into farming, and this was around farming cattle around 2003, 2004, I thought I saw this organic label and I thought, well, I'll go organic because I know I can't make money this other way. By the way, I started out with 8 cows, and when I sold the first calves at the stockyards, I'm like, how is anybody making money at this, right? I'm not even counting my labor yet or the opportunity cost of my land, and I just lost money on my first set of calves. I need to do something different. So I looked into organic, and I went shopping with my wife, and I started buying all organic stuff, and I pulled some apple juice off the shelf, and it said organic, USDA, certified USDA organic. I stuck it in the cart, and before we got to the checkout line, I looked at the label and it says product of Turkey. And I fell for it myself. I thought, if something is USDA, if it's got a USDA sticker on it, particularly if it's organic, then certainly it must be from the USA. And I think, and by the way, what I ultimately decided was that the organic label was, I don't know if it's this way in all endeavors, but for beef, it was just, practically impossible to do, at least in my region, because I couldn't buy hay. There's nobody that raises organic hay near me. So what I see and what I've fallen for myself before I got into farming is, when I see that USDA label and there's no other label on there, then I'm going to assume that's USA. And so that's basically every package of meat in the supermarket that doesn't have a country of origin label on it.
Right.
Now, you could do voluntary country of origin labeling. Well, in 2015, when Congress repealed the country of origin labeling law, I offered an amendment to replace it with a voluntary labeling, which would say that the meat's got to be born, raised, and slaughtered in the USA if you want to put the USA, label on it. And you could do it voluntarily or you don't do it voluntarily. But they wouldn't even allow that. They wouldn't even allow a vote on that amendment. They shut it down in the Rules Committee. And I thought that was disingenuous of them, because they've always said, well, you could do voluntary. But what does it mean if the voluntary, if you label it USA or USDA and the animal spent 12 hours in the USA before it was butchered? It doesn't mean anything.
Well, all they have to do, Tom, basically, is just repackage it or just do minimal processing once the meat arrives for a foreign country, and they can say made in the USA?
Well, my impression is that they bring them in as live animals and butcher them here, although maybe they're bringing in parts of it and then repackaging it. I don't know. But there's what I do know is that when I tried to offer some guidelines in Congress, they refused to let us vote on it. So if there is any kind of regulation, it would be just some regulatory whim from the USDA. It wouldn't be anything, any law that Congress has passed.
Concerning the WTO, it's just maddening that food policy or food laws can be made in Geneva or Brussels instead of Washington, when especially food is really your front line of national security. A country needs to be self-sufficient, needs to have the ability to feed itself. And you mentioned, I think earlier, just you were interested in finding out if Canada or Mexico have laws that are maybe similar to the Prime Act. And I think Mexico needs a look, because it seems like if there isn't legal non-inspected meat there, just from this report I saw, I think there's a lot of bootleg meat being sold in the markets there. So just who is it for the WTO to tell the U.S. to tell the U.S. how to...
The U.S. Congress, yes.
To such a crucial national security issue for this country.
Well, here's... Okay, allow me to indulge in a little bit of conspiracy theory, but I don't think I'm very far off the mark here, because if you follow the money, this is the way it would go down. The U.S. was sued, not by Europe, not by China, but by Canada and Mexico. And this was not under NAFTA, this was under GATT, which happened like a year before. They cited GATT, and they sued the United States for our mandatory country of origin labeling law. And they said, oh, you're requiring, you are depressing the price that meat packers in the United States are willing to pay for Canadian and Mexican animals, because they have to keep separate they have to keep separate lots, and it costs more to build another lot if they want to keep the animals separate, to keep them, you know, one from one country or one from another. And so they came up with this whole tortured reasoning. By the way, your vegetables are still labeled, your fruit still labeled, your fish is still labeled, your car, your shoes, your tools, your computers, your phone, all that still got country of origin labeling. But they came up with this tortured logic for why it was prejudicial against foreign beef to have a country of origin labeling on beef in the United States. Now, here's where my conspiracy theory kicks in. I don't think there were elected officials or even bureaucrats in Canada and Mexico who said, you know what, I think we should sue the United States. They didn't just wake up one day and say, I think we should sue the United States. It was a trade organization, okay? There was some lobbyists that got to him and said, we think you should sue the United States. And I suspect that trade organization is one of the, you know, is a conglomerate that includes the meat packers in the United States, part of the 85% that control all, part of the four companies that control 85% of the meat processing in the United States. It's not that much of a conspiracy to go out on a limb to believe that they are the ones who put Canada and Mexico up to suing the United States government. So ostensibly, this was a battle between governments and some extra constitutional government called the World Trade Organization. But in reality, I think it was these meat processors in the United States who wanted to process foreign animals, sell them with a USDA label, and not have consumers know any different. And that way, they can also take the U.S. farmers to the cleaners when they go to buy their cattle. And that's my theory on how this thing all went down. And then at the end of the day, when I tried to rally the Beef Association and even the Farm Bureau to help me fight the removal of country of origin labeling, they wanted nothing to do with the fight. In fact, the Beef Association wanted to get rid of country of origin labeling. The U.S., the National Cattlemen's Association, right? They were in on this to get rid of country of origin labeling. And then the Farm Bureau, they were in on it too. Now they would say, well, we didn't want retaliatory tariffs on our soybean and corn farmers because that's what was going to come next. The WTO was going to authorize retaliatory tariffs on other farm products from the United States into Canada and Mexico. That was their story. But why am I going into all this? Because I have a front row seat to all of this in Washington, D.C. I see it. I hear it. I talk to the groups. I try to get them to rally behind these efforts for farmers, and they either sit on their hands or they're working in the other direction. So if you're a farmer and you're listening to this and you belong to one of those organizations like Farm Bureau or National Cattlemen's Association, pick up the phone and ask them what the hell they're doing for you.
Another argument they're using against the Prime Act, Tom, this is through the Packers again, and some of the other major associations you referenced, was the food safety issue. They're playing the fear card. And what they're saying is no inspector is present when just the animal is being slaughtered, meat from the animals being processed. Well, when you look at the way the industrial system goes, and this has been in the media, I think, in Bloomberg News the last few months, Bloomberg had a story where they said 50 plants account for 98% of the beef production in this country. And you're talking about plants that are processing 300 to 400 animals an hour. So they have an inspector there. So even with an inspector, what is the quality control when you're processing 300 to 400 animals an hour compared to a custom house where you might process 3 to 6 beeves an entire day? They do more animals in a day than most of these beeves in a day than these custom houses do an entire year. And they're making this food safety argument, and I don't think it's an argument they're entitled to.
And look, and where are all the recalls from? They're from all the USDA facilities. The USDA label is basically what it does. It doesn't guarantee food safety. It launders the accountability and the liability for the meat processor is what it does. Because if they've got the imprimatur of the U.S. government saying that that food is safe, then when you get sick from that food, who do you blame? You blame the government. You don't blame the meat processor. And that's what the USDA label does for you. And listen, I told you before, I sell cattle into both markets. I sell them direct to consumer and I sell it into that other market. And by the way, Pete, I eat beef. I unlike Joel Salatin, I'll stop at McDonald's and eat a hamburger, okay? He's way more pure than me, and you may be too, but I'll eat a steak in a restaurant. But I'll tell you what, the steak that I eat from a local processor, I will eat that thing as rare as you want to cook it. But when I go out to eat, I don't really want to see any pink in my hamburger, okay? Because I know that the recalls for E. coli do not come from local processors. They come from the big plants. And by the way, like you were talking about at scale, when you buy a hamburger that's produced in one of those large facilities, they aren't processing one animal at a time. You can't do 100 animals an hour and do one animal at a time. You've got a grinder that's set up to do hamburger. And you may have dozens of animals in that hamburger that you're eating if it came from a supermarket. Now, I'm not saying different species of animals. I'm saying they're all cattle, but they could be from different farms, different breeds, raised differently. And one of them might have been sick. But you don't know that. And that's the problem. And that's why it's safer when you do it in small batches instead of large batches. But again, I'm not trying to create some kind of panic in the overall larger market. I'll still buy and eat hamburgers and steaks. The steaks I won't eat as rare as I do it from a local processor, and the hamburger I don't want to eat it pink at all.
Yeah. In 12 or 13 years of working on this issue, I've never heard of a single foodborne illness outbreak attributed to a custom house. And with USDA, you get these cases, just these multi-state outbreaks, whether it's E. coli in beef or some pathogen in pork where there can be hundreds of people sick at a time. And, you know, the inspectors have a thankless job there, I think, with some of the long, complex supply chains they're dealing with and the imported, all the imported meat coming in these days. But it just seems like if you want the safest food safety system, you get as much of your food as possible produced locally. And just the single biggest weakness in the local food system right now by far is the lack of slaughterhouse infrastructure.
You know, one thing that I've heard, one objection to the Prime Act is that the supermarket chains won't carry the local beef, even though the Prime Act would allow you to sell in a supermarket. The supermarket chains wouldn't carry it because they're worried about the liability of it. And they say, well, how do you address the liability? And they say, I want liability, right? The problem we have now is there is no liability. And so if the supermarket chains, if their bureaucracy and their understanding of liability doesn't permit them to sell it, then fine. That's another reason to go to your local grocer, who's going to probably know the local farmer and the local processor and will have no problem whatsoever selling that unique product. It's not a commodity at that point. It's something that you've got to go to this store to get. But at least now the farmer has an outlet for that in the normal commercial means.
Right. And just one of the big problems the farmers have is these grocers require product liability insurance. And as you know, it's expensive and not always that easy to get for small livestock farmer, which I guess brings us into the Subprime Act, which you've spoken about. I mean, people are talking about possible compromises on the bill. Just the original bill would have allowed the states to pass laws allowing sales to grocery stores, restaurants, direct to consumer. I mean, there have been number of people saying, what about if, you know, we reduce the scope of the bill to just allow sales to direct to consumer? What's the feedback you're hearing on that? Is any kind of consensus formed on that?
So it's hard for me, having so much personal ownership and pride in this bill, to figure out ways to brain damage it so that it could be more easily passed in Congress. But I have undergone that exercise because I do want to get something done. And the one way that I refuse to brain damage the bill is to make it a pilot program or for a limited period of time. If you do that, then you won't see the main benefit of the Prime Act, which would be to encourage processors to expand their facilities and encourage new processors to go into business, right? They're not going to do that for a pilot program or something that could go away in 6 months or a year. But there are ways that I think you could reduce the scope of the bill that would still give some freedom to farmers. For instance, I've heard people say, well, the problem with the Prime Act is you could have unsophisticated customers who don't understand the product that they're buying. Okay, well, how's that any different than what's happening right now? But anyways, so if you took out the supermarket or grocery store sales, let's say that the sale had to happen directly between the farmer and the consumer, or between the processor and the consumer. It's hard to say that that's not a sophisticated consumer and they think they're buying, you know, the same thing they were buying before. They're going to know it's different if they're buying it directly from the farmer or from the processor. And there's a tighter chain of accountability there. That would still be a big win for farmers. It's, you know, it's like, was it in Mississippi, you said the ag commissioner issued an emergency declaration to say that any number of people could buy ownership in a live animal and therefore use the USDA exemption that allows you to use a custom slaughterhouse if you own the animal.
Right.
It would be akin to that, but it would be making it a law instead of sort of a decree, and it would be giving some certainty to the farmers and to the processors. And so that would still be a win, I believe. That's one way you could do it. You could limit the number of animals that are processed, because I've heard people say, oh, well, the big guys will use this exemption and they'll produce shoddy meat and they'll scale up. Well, you could limit the number of animals you could process in a day or a year, although I'm not really keen on that. Again, I think the small business exemption keeps small businesses small when you hit that limit. But that is something else you could do. Because we have the 20,000 bird exemption for poultry, and that hasn't started any trade wars, you know, with other countries, I think that's a good example for why this bill, there's some way to construct this bill, I'm open to amendments, that averts any sort of trade wars, because that's one of the objections that's raised is, oh, we can't do this, or else there'll be unfair differential treatment for domestic suppliers versus foreign suppliers. Well, if they had to limit it to 100 animals a month or something, I don't think that would be considered unfair.
Right. Have you also had people discuss with you the possibility of limiting the number of employees in these plants, so Mr. Cargill couldn't step in? I mean, I've never heard of a strictly custom facility with maybe even 25 employees. So is that another proposed compromise someone's run by you?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't heard that one, or maybe I heard it and forgot it, but I'd be open to that. I'm basically open to anything. I call it the Subprime Act or the Choice Act, the Select Act, any grade less than prime. But I think really the full Prime Act would be the best way to go. And you do get a little bit of pushback from some of these small processors who've decided to make the big jump and do the USDA certification. Now they're invested in the bureaucracy, and so some of those are against the Prime Act. But ironically, most of the people, the smaller processors that are USDA, or at least the one sample I know, which is the one I take my cattle to, they're in favor of the Prime Act. Why would you support the Prime Act? You've gone to all the costs and the expense and aggravation of doing the USDA certification. Why would you support the Prime Act? And they say, well, we still have the benefit that we can sell interstate, because we've, you know, even when the Prime Act passes, it's still an advantage for us. We can still justify the extra cost if it allows us to sell interstate. But they said, frankly, we want more local processors because we can't supply the demand. And we know our demand goes up and is more certain if consumers get used to buying local food. So the USDA facility 3 hours from my house, they're actually in favor of the Prime Act, even though ostensibly on the surface, it doesn't look like it benefits them.
Right. Growing the pie instead of worrying about who's right. going to get what out of the existing pie.
Right. Yeah. Growing the pie. I like that analogy.
Yeah, let's,
Any food.
Right. Yeah. So there's some... Let's talk about upcoming possibilities for the Prime Act. I mean, there's some of these multi-subject bills. I mean, the stimulus bill might be one. I mean, and you've had success with that in the past. You mentioned earlier that you worked in the 2014 Farm Bill, and I think it was some hemp pilot research project yep. you got included. So, yeah, could you talk to kind of the strategies working on these sure. multi-subject bills and how you're able to succeed through them?
And by the way, the hemp pilot program we got on the Farm Bill in 2014 was a permanent pilot program, by the way. In other words, it right. never went away. It wasn't of a limited time. And so people looked at it and they sized it up and they said, I think I can go into business using this pilot program and it's not going to go away. So that is a good analogy. Also, it was germane to the Farm Bill. Okay. It had to do with farming, right?
Right.
So I would argue that because COVID has surfaced the problems that we have in our food supply, when we now know it's too brittle, we now know our food supply as it's currently constructed to get from the farmer to the consumer is a national security issue, okay, in times of a virus or some other national emergency. And so I think it would be germane to put something like the PRIME Act, on the next COVID relief bill, although it doesn't spend a lot of money. I mean, that, the one thing that everything in that bill seems to have in common with the other parts of the bill is they are all, everybody's trying to spend money or grease somebody's hand somewhere. This doesn't do that, so it may not. It may be incongruous to the people in Washington, D.C., my colleagues who are crafting the next bailout bill. But I think it's very congruous if you realize that what it does is it makes our country more food secure and addresses this issue, not just the issue of this virus, but any further potential future virus or bacteria or you know, disruption. This would make our food supply more robust without spending money.
Well, Tom, there's been a lot of support for the PRIME Act the last couple months. They're just getting close to where we've got the potential of getting something done. What can people do right now to help in support of the legislation?
That's the most important question you've asked me today.
Right.
The main thing you can do is call up. Don't tweet at him or her. Don't Facebook them. Call them up. Pick up the phone and call their office, okay? Call the Congressional Switchboard if you don't know their number. And ask your congressman to support H.R. 2859. It's called the PRIME Act. Just tell him Congressman Massey's PRIME Act if you can't remember the name, the number of the bill. There's a Senate bill. I don't remember the number of it, but you can remember the sponsor, Angus King. Tell them, tell your two senators. All I'm asking you to do is make three phone calls because everybody has two senators and one U.S. representative. Don't call Nancy Pelosi and don't call Mitch McConnell unless they are your senator and congresswoman, right? Call the three people you can vote for, your two senators and your U.S. representative, and ask them to sponsor this. That will give us the biggest and best chance of getting this bill on the floor or in a committee for a hearing or in the next bill, COVID bill.
Okay, Congressman Tom Massey, greatly appreciate your time. Best of success in your general election this fall, and best of success with the PRIME Act.
Thank you so much, Pete. Talk to you later.
Take care.